I'm here with tonight with Chuck Missler, who is co-author of a book called Alien Encounters. Last year, you'll probably remember, we interviewed Chuck in September of last year, and we talked about this very, very timely and interesting book. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program tonight Chuck Missler. Good evening, Chuck.
Mike, nice to be back with you. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
I appreciate you you taking the time to be on the program with us. Let's, for the audience that did not hear that program a year ago, let's bring them up to speed. What is Alien Encounters about?
Well, it's about UFOs, but from an unusual point of view. My co-author was Dr. Mark Eastman, and he and I both became concerned a couple of years back that there is a deception coming upon the world in general, but the body of Christ, the Christians in particular. And so the original title for the book was Cosmic Deception, frankly. But as we got into it more and more, we repackaged the styling of the book, but not the content really, and called it Alien Encounters. And basically what the book, what it dealt with was, first of all, just the reality of the UFOs. It shocks many people to discover that 13 of our astronauts have verified the fact that there are some strange things going on, that these reports are not limited to what we might call the lunatic fringe, as many people presume.
Right.
They actually show up on radar, et cetera. So the early part of the book, of course, sets that platform. What the book also ultimately dealt with is that there are a large number, a surprising segment of our population, that that believes they've had an encounter with the occupants of these would-be vehicles. And there have been technical conferences at MIT and elsewhere on this subject, so we talk a little bit about that. But what made the book very controversial was not the UFO part of the book. The book has 14 chapters. You could read 9 of the 14 chapters before you realize that both Mark and I have a strong biblical foundation. And part of what we deal with in chapter 10 and following is what the biblical implications of these things are.
Okay.
And what surprised us was that the book became quite controversial, not because of the UFO stuff, but we develop a pretty strong case for the very traditional understanding of Genesis chapter 6, both from a Jewish or rabbinical point of view and also from the point of view of the early church. And the whole idea that this kind of thing that seems to be going on in our society today apparently was the cause of Noah's flood. So we got into all of that. The positions we took are really not at variance with the classical view held by the early church and of course, the Jewish rabbis for centuries. So in any case, the book was sort of a hot product back a year ago when we talked about it, and still doing well. It was given quite to a lot of people bought it for Christmas gifts last year, and we've had an enormous amount of mail of people whose lives were favorably impacted by the book, so we're very gratified.
Well, that's good. I guess a good starting point then would be, and it's something that I myself am very fascinated with, is the book of Genesis, chapter 6. Now, in...
Okay, we'll jump right into the weird part of this. The Genesis chapter 6 lays the basis for the flood of Noah. When you stand back and realize that God chose to literally wipe out the entire world except for 9 people, one that he removed in advance, and then 8 that were preserved through this mechanism of the ark, which we all, most of us, I think, know the story.
Right.
It's amazing how many pastors, how many people that are professionally trained biblically have never really studied properly what the text in Genesis 6 actually says.
Now, before you get to that, I want to interject something, because myself, my audience knows that I'm Christian, and that I'm interested in the topic of UFOs, which is basically the scope of the program. But I have asked theologians and people that I know in the clergy about Genesis chapter 6, and a majority of them kind of cock an eyebrow at me.
Sure.
I ask them, does Genesis 6 mean this? Now, go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm glad you put that foundation down, because, see, Jesus Christ, in speaking to his disciples about his second coming, makes a strange remark. He says it'll be like the days, as the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the
right.
Son of Man B. Well, the reason that doesn't mean much to us is because we haven't really done our homework as to what the days of Noah were like. So you get to Genesis chapter 6. Most people don't realize that the first two verses are one sentence. And in the English translation, it reads as follows. It came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all whom they chose, period. Now, the problem occurs, the phrase that's translated sons of God is a Hebrew term, B'nai HaElohim. It's a term that is precisely and exclusively used in the Old Testament of angels.
Right.
It's a term that was recognized by the ancient scholars, the rabbinical scholars, when the Bible was translated into Greek 3 centuries before Christ was born, a very authoritative translation. They understood that term to mean angels, fallen angels, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And the passage goes on, in verse 4, it says there were giants in the earth in those days. The word actually translated giants in the Hebrew is Nephilim, which comes from the word Nephal, the fallen ones.
Right.
What the passage, in a sense, says, if you take it for what it says, is apparently, back then, somehow, some fallen angels somehow got involved with human women and developed a hybrid, which are called the Nephilim. And as you read chapter 6, and I won't take you through all the other textual, but again, it's reconfirmed several times in the chapter, apparently what was going on the earth was a corruption of the human line that created a problem for God's plan of redemption, such that he, so to speak, erased the blackboard. He picked 8 that were uncontaminated. In verse 9 of chapter 6, it points out that one of the distinctives of Noah was that his genealogy was free of physical defect. In other words, he says it was perfect in his generations. His genealogy didn't have blemishes. The word there is tamim, which is used of a physical blemish. In other words, what apparently the picture portrays is that Noah was distinctive in that his genealogy, he didn't have this genetic defect that was introduced into these by means of these hybrids.
Right.
Now, the reason this becomes so significant is twofold. First of all, it gives us a hint of the kinds of things that led to the flood in the first place. And because of the remark that Jesus made, the implication is that this kind of thing or something like it will reoccur as one of the symptomatic aspects of what we call the end times. And one of the conjectures by the book, and it's strictly a conjecture, but it's a provocative one, that some of what seems to be going on in what we would call the UFO area and these encounters that people report seem to, strangely, be echoes of what apparently went on before the flood. But the second reason this is significant for perspective is the chapter 6 also indicates these things happened also after the flood. In other words, we're not through. Even after the flood, apparently there were still some goings-on like this that led to certain tribes in the land of Canaan that God instructed Joshua to wipe out every man, woman, and child of certain tribes. When we read that as a New Testament reader, it shocks us. It sounds so barbaric. And that's because we don't understand
what was going on.
Exactly.
And I want to focus a little bit more on this, because I know, Chuck, that a lot of people that I've talked to about this theory, Christian people I've talked to about this theory, I don't, you know, it's almost like some types of religious thought are in a vacuum. Now, I've researched certain parts of this myself, and I'm in full agreement with you in your interpretation of these things, because what I'm finding as well is that there appears to have been a considerable amount of corruption going on here before the flood, and that the flood was specifically, as you mentioned, was specifically brought upon the earth to eradicate or erase this corruption, this mixing of...
A gene pool problem.
Exactly. And the problem is that we find in the Old Testament, beyond Genesis and Exodus and all these other chapters, we find, the fingerprint of the Nephilim. They're referenced in Chronicles, for example, as having 6 fingers and 6 toes.
Exactly. That's what Goliath was a descendant of those.
Okay.
And he had 4 brothers.
One of the other things, too, that I find really interesting, and help me out with this, if I'm wrong about this, cool, I get it straightened out. But One of the things that's always fascinated me about the story of Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah is the fact that the townspeople that wanted Lot to send out his visitors knew that his visitors were angelic beings.
Yes.
And it seems like when you study...
Well, hang on. Let me just stop there. They may not have known that they were angels.
Okay.
They knew that they were attractive men. The problem there clearly is one of widespread homosexuality.
Right.
In fact, Lot does gives them the rather startling offer. He offers his daughters instead rather than to have his visitors abused, because Lot, of course, knew who they were.
Well, let me interject real quick there, because this one thing I want to kind of flesh out as a point is, and we see this happening today, it appears from when you study history and archaeology and anthropology going back to the ancient times, it appears that certain things are certain forms of Baal worship and certain things that were coming out of the Chaldeans and the Babylonians had to do with the desire of human beings to have unnatural sexual acts.
Oh, yes.
Meaning having sexual acts with beings or creatures that were not human in nature.
Exactly right. That is an obsession in the ancient cultures, and we even find those kinds of tales entangled with many of the current UFO report.
Precisely, and that's the point I was trying to make, is that it appears, at least my reading of the Bible, and a verse in Jude in the New Testament,
right on,
basically points back to the Old Testament and the visitors with Lot at Sodom and Gomorrah, that they sought to have unnatural relations.
Strange flesh, exactly.
Exactly.
Both Jude in verses 5 and 6, one chapter book, verses 5 and 6, and also Peter in a second letter, chapter 2, verse 4, both of them make reference to the events of Genesis 6 and indicate they were angels that went after, from the angels' point of view, the angels went after strange flesh, just as they did in Sodom and so forth. Now, one of the problems that many Christians have, many contemporary Christians have, is they get confused because Jesus made the remark having to do with angels in heaven that they don't marry.
Right.
And he's talking about angels in heaven, and he doesn't say they don't have sex, he says they don't marry.
Right.
There's subtlety there. The point is, that is no excuse to put a constraint on the technology available to a fallen angel who's up to mischief. Do you follow me?
Yes, I do.
And so there's a huge debate with among many theologians because they misinterpret what Jesus said, which is, I don't want to really get into this, it gets very technical, but the point is when an angel has fallen, the kind of technology available to these creatures, I believe it can be quite staggering, and I wouldn't put any constraints on it. And I view the whole thing in Genesis 6 as a satanic plot where Satan's attempting to thwart
exactly
the promises.
Exactly.
And you can map the entire Bible from Genesis to Revelation as a saga, as a drama.
Yes.
Again and again and again, Satan attempts to thwart the plan that God has for the redemption of mankind. And the Nephilim of Genesis 6, or the Nephilim, when Moses sent in the 12 spies to spy out the land at Kadesh Barnea, 10 of them came back, and they said they found Nephilim in the land. The word there, he said there were giants in the land. The word is actually Nephilim, the same word that's used in Genesis 6. So the point is, what we're really pushing for in the book, is, and we try to document it quite thoroughly, is for the biblically sophisticated person to do their own homework and do their digging. And I've had vice presidents of publishing, Christian publishers, call me, and they're really angry, not at me. They said they graduated from seminary and had never been taught this.
Exactly. And see, the point of this program tonight, interviewing you, is to set a basically to advance, I should say, a theory that is well-founded to Christian listeners and non-Christian listeners as well. But basically, you know, the Christian topic as it pertains to anything at all having to do with the subject of the paranormal seems to get laughed out of court, if you will, because it seems like not to be a popular notion. However, you know, people can't deny the fact that these stories that are in the Bible are archaeologically proven to be correct and accurate.
Exactly.
I think it has everything to do with this.
And also, even in the New Testament context, Paul hammers away that we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and, you know, spiritual wickedness in high places. One of the things that, you know, the book, of course, was intended, it was aimed at the Christian reader, to wake them to a reality that has biblical relevance.
Mm-hmm.
But we've discovered that the book became very popular with us gifts, especially at Christmas, that sort of thing, to friends, because it's a well-packaged book and it's provocatively written. It's attractive in that sense.
Right.
It also has caused, what we're very gratified, surprised, frankly, that it's caused lives to be changed, where people who are not necessarily drawn into what I'll call the Christian community, it startled them enough to do a little homework and caused them to recognize that the aspects of our lives that are physical and tangible are a small part of what's really impacting us, and that there is a spiritual world. And in fact, one of the other things, funny, some people called me just today about this, the two scientists that are not Christians, to the best of my knowledge, the two scientists that know the most respected people in the UFO world, one was J. Allen Hynek, the
right.
American,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is Jacques Vallée from France. Both of these are reputed to be as just secular scientists, but they've studied the UFO thing for many, many decades. J. Allen Hynek died a few years ago, but Jacques Vallée is still around. Both of them, in their most recent writings, came to the conclusion that these UFOs are real in the sense they show up on radar, they leave physical evidences behind like radiation and so forth, on the one hand. On the other hand, they clearly violate the laws of physics as we know them. They make right-angle turns at very, very high speeds. They go faster than the speed of sound without sonic booms, etc.
Right.
The point is, they have both of them came to the conclusions that these things are not from some other galaxy, although they pose to be, that they're extra-dimensional, and they're, in effect, demonic, and that's their term. And that startled me to discover that, because that's the kind of term that many Christians are even uncomfortable with. And yet, that's clearly the kind of behavior they exhibit, and that's clearly the presentation that the Bible puts on these things. And so it's a very interesting place to do a little homework, because, first of all, it's rather provocative in terms of just contemporary interest, but it also is profound in terms of its implications
right.
for each of us in terms of recognizing, coming to grips with the reality of the universe we live in, that it's not just limited to the in fact, that's the other aspect. We tend to think of three dimensions plus time, call time a fourth dimension for this purpose. The particle physicists have told us today, they've now discovered that we live in at least 10 dimensions. Four of them are directly measurable, length, width, height, and time. But six of them are curled in less than 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, to use vector calculus terms. And so they can only be inferred by indirect means. And the view by Jacques Vallée and other researchers is that this phenomenon we're dealing with is extra-dimensional. And our book, of course, tries to build that kind of understanding of hyperspaces and the rest as we get into this. But so it's an interesting area to do some homework in. But it also has a warning in the sense that to the extent that these things are real and to the extent that one has an encounter with them, they can be very dangerous.
Okay, now hold that. When we come back from break, we'll delve into that. We're going to look at the agenda. What do they really want with us? It might surprise many of you, so stay tuned. My guest is Chuck Missler. He's co-author of a book, Alien Encounters. And even though this book was published a year ago, it is still very timely. It is available out there. And Chuck will give you a web address and other information about how you can get information about his organization as well. We're going to get all of that in just a minute. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Corbin. You're listening to the Paranet Continuum. We'll be right back. Returning is my guest, Chuck Missler, co-author of Alien Encounters, and as you heard, there's not a lot that you can really do to dismiss the Christian angle over what UFOs and the paranormal may be, as Chuck is mentioning, because we're talking about stuff that is very well written about, very in detail, actually, concerning some of the things that go on with fallen angels, the Nephilim, as he's called them, and of course, as I mentioned in the first segment, when you get into the history of this stuff, and I think Chuck will agree, we find some very interesting things that parallel the Bible that deal with the Nephilim, the six-finger, six-toed kind of thing, and that type of deal. It appears that their fingerprint has been there for a long, long time. Would you agree?
Sure do. In fact, one of the interesting discoveries as you get into this is that every ancient culture, the Sumers, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Persians, you can go through all the ancient cultures, even the South Sea Islanders and our American Indians, all of them have embedded in their legends and myths, they record a time early in the early years in which somehow some star people or some, the Greeks have their gods that came down and cohabited with women and had a hybrid offspring.
Right.
What the Greeks called them, the Titans. They were half men, half gods. The Hebrew term would be Nephilim. And it's interesting that those ideas echo in the legends of every ancient culture. The American Indians talk about the star people that came down. That when they met a stranger, they'd always hold up their hand. You know, the Hollywood always has done that with Howl and all that foolishness. But I understand that there was a tradition of when you met someone from a strange tribe to hold up your hand so they could count fingers because they had a sphere of 600
sure.
people.
Uh-huh.
You find that in those petroglyphs and stuff. But the point is, the Greek traditions are the interesting ones too because we all have heard about Greek mythology.
Right.
It would seem that that has its roots, if you will, in the events that we know of as Genesis chapter 6.
I've always wanted to ask somebody who's knowledgeable, which you seem to be pretty knowledgeable, is it kind of out of line to possibly think that the mythology, the stories of mythology, are somewhat based on some kind of truth?
I do. No, by the way, John Fleming did a classic work in 1879,
uh-huh.
The Fallen Angels and the Heroes of Mythology. The mythology, of course, is we feel is a corruption of it, but based originally that they're echoing the same events that are recorded in Genesis chapter 6, in effect, okay?
Right.
Now, let me mention one other, just so we can be a little more precise. The Fallen Angels are the actors here, the hybrid offspring of the angels and the human women were the fallen ones, the Nephilim, and or Titans in the Greek terminology.
Mm-hmm.
The reason this becomes relevant, the reason we even get into this, isn't because of the misty past, but because of the peculiar events that are starting to emerge with the UFO reports. It's interesting that especially in more recent years, we encounter again and again and again people who at least have the belief that they've had an abduction experience by the occupants of these UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this may sound, you say, well, these are some lunatic fringe weirdos. Turns out that these kinds of reports are frequent enough to have caused a major concern in the field of psychiatry. There was a conference at MIT chaired by John Mack, and I forgot who the other guy was, two co-chairmen.
Pritchard, I think.
On this whole idea of the abduction experiences. And their point is, see, these stories that you hear are too weird to accept on the one hand,
uh-huh.
but they're too consistent and too frequent to ignore. And as they study this area, they discover that almost all of these reports of so-called abductions or whatever they are, involve apparently intrusive medical procedures and generally preoccupied somehow with the human reproductive process. And John Mack himself, he was the head of psychiatry for Harvard, and he shocked the professional community by coming out publicly and saying that he apparently, I think he had personally dealt with 76 of these cases.
Right.
And he has come to the conclusion, announced publicly, that he believes that these creatures are real and that they have an agenda to create a hybrid race. Now, that doesn't mean he's right, but it does. He has 150 peer-reviewed journal articles to his credit. He's a guy with all the right credentials. The point is, this whole area of abduction, his challenge to the conference at MIT was, if what these people are saying is happening to them, if it isn't happening, what is happening? And by the way, these people have been profiled. They're above average, typically they're above average intelligence. They have no prior psychiatric history, and they clearly have been subjected to some kind of traumatic experience.
Right, I agree with that.
And so there's a whole field, and again, it's the kind of thing, when you first hear about it, you sort of write off as weirdness. At the same time, it's managed to get the serious concern of practitioners, psychiatry and psychologist type practitioners, counselors in this field, because these people are troubled, and they've also discovered some of them even have scars and lesions and what have you that are associated with their reported experience. So that's why we call the book Alien Encounters, because people who've been following this area are starting to get concerned. There have been surveys, polls taken, that estimate more than 1% of the population appears to have had some kind of experience that causes them to believe they've had this an abduction experience.
I think it's starting. I think that those figures may be very conservative.
I think they are. I'm just trying not to sound too.
No, but I, you know,
I think the point, the reason we wrote the book is that these things are, if they're real, they're dangerous.
Exactly. And one thing I want to say when I said about the conservative figures of the polls, you know, you seem like everybody you talk to anymore has had some kind of paranormal experience. However, let it be said that not I nor you were the ones that even began to connect certain dots. You mentioned him earlier, Dr. Jacques Vallée. In fact, after many years of researching this topic and subject, what started out as just UFOs and isolated sighting reports, Jacques has now connected to other paranormal experiences, i.e. ghosts, poltergeists, you know, all kinds of other bizarre activities. So this just does not seem to be confined to UFOs and little green men from Mars.
You're exactly right. And in fact, what we're dealing with here is a whole world that represents high risk. Now, many people, some of your audience might say, I don't believe any of that stuff, and that's fine. That's their view. They, you know, that's a different kind of risk. But there are many that are willing to accept this, thinking that there's value there, that there is, it's a seductive area. And I have to go on record to highlight that fooling around in this area is dangerous, because we believe these things are demonic. They have tremendous capability of posing as pretending something they're not. Their goal is deception. They are satanic in their origin. And I'm mentioning all of this to raise a caution flag. If someone is going to get into this area, it's very, very important that they have the benefit of a good biblical background. Otherwise, they will be ensnared in a situation that has their destruction as its goal.
Exactly. Exactly. That's, unfortunately, and I think that nobody can really deny this, we see this every day.
I had when we had a broadcast on this area, and I remember I got a call, and I won't mention his name so I can speak freely because I don't have his permission, but it turned out to be a top executive at Universal Studios.
Uh-huh.
And he called me and he says, Chuck, I heard your broadcast where you're talking about Nephilim and all that, and you're right on target. I happen to be expert in this area because I participated in a number of projects in this area. You were right on target until you got to the point where you said that a Christian cannot be abducted. And I got so upset that I had to track you down and call you because I believe you're wrong. He says, you need to investigate the Andreessen affair. I was also startled by the phone call. I just polite. I just tried to absorb it all. Well, I did subsequently look into the Andreessen affair, and this is covered in our book, by the way. It turned out that Betty Andreessen was a person who was a Christian for 20 years in a spirit-filled fellowship that apparently had some kind of abduction experience. But if you read the affidavit carefully, you'll discover that she had an invitation by them and accepted the invitation. That's not an abduction. In other words, I still hold my ground. I believe that a Christian, someone that is in Christ, has a protection against this kind of abuse. But the point is, we do include in our book an appendix of just a brief checklist of would-be contactees, things to be aware of. And what we, even Jacques Vallée makes the remark, by the way, is if you have such an experience, don't allow yourself to get hypnotized. And there's some very strange dynamics you want to be aware of.
So the will of the person is very important.
Exactly. The gate of the will is crucial for your whole spiritual welfare. If you do, if anyone listening to this program has finds themselves in some kind of encounter, I strongly urge you to flee it. I strongly urge you not to accept any such invitations and to do your spiritual, find a pastor, someone skilled in what would be called a deliverance ministry, and do some homework, because these things are very dangerous, and I know that we're probably talking to a small percentage of the population, but it's of great concern. And if we're correct, and this is a test you can make, if we're correct in our book, as the years go by, it's our belief that the frequency of these kinds of things is going to increase.
Right.
We think there's an agenda. We think there's a broad agenda. If we're correct, if we understand this correctly, that's a big if. This thing is going to continue to increase. We're going to our whole world view is going to go increasingly into what now would be considered a freaky area, and I think we need to be spiritually equipped. And obviously, we believe that the Bible is the only reliable place to be grounded for this kind of thing.
You betcha. There's a lot of weird things coming down the pike, I think a lot of people will admit. Chuck Missler is my guest. Stay tuned. There's a lot more to come. We'll be right back after this. My guest is Chuck Missler, co-author of Alien Encounters, and we're getting into some pretty heavy stuff, which I find it very interesting, and I think it's something that, again, is timely. As we approach the end of the millennium, there's a lot of people, Chuck, and I'm sure you hear this, there's a lot of people running around with a lot of uncertainty about the future.
Oh, indeed, and it's always, we've always been concerned about the future, but when you get to these to a major milestone like the end of the century, or especially the end of the millennium, that will waltz out all the all the kooks and nuts with their theories,
and
it's a time of strangeness in many, many ways, especially the one we're facing, because there are in fact a lot of changes on the horizon. But I think that in the paranormal area, the parapsychology area, it's especially vulnerable to alternative theories and views, because it's so hard to do objective testing and to anchor this in some kind of empirical foundation.
I think that's one of the features of it, too, that make it so, appealing to some people, is that it's how elusive it is.
Exactly. And, in fact, one of the things that we try to deal with in our book, and I really owe an enormous debt to Mark Eastman, because he did most of the real spade work in this area, is the so-called New Age. There's a whole body of literature that has sprung up in the last 10, 15 years, which is typically, you go into a bookstore, the New Age shelves are just full of various theories and conjectures, and we have so-called channelers or mediums, if you will.
Right.
And there's a close interbreeding, if you will, between some of these views and entanglements and the UFO area. And I think the forces, whatever they are, of the UFO world are very much taking advantage of this area. I sometimes joke about Mark Eastman and I. We sort of divided up the job 50-50. He did all the work and I take all the credit. He really did an excellent job.
You're a good boss.
Huh?
You're a good boss.
Oh, no, he's a good partner. And he really did the homework canvassing the New Age literature, especially focusing on the intersection of that body of viewpoint and the UFO world. In fact, this extends in some other areas too. The Vatican has had spokesman Balducci and others on Italian television pointed out that the Vatican, of course, has an intelligence network probably second to none in the world. And he announced that they've known about the UFOs for many, many years. They're well documented, all that sort of stuff. But they take the position publicly that of these aliens and whatever, they're the good guys and the bad guys, that they're not necessarily evil. Some are and some aren't. And I think they take that position because embraced within it are the Marian apparitions of
right.
the West. And so that's a whole other controversial area. I'll stay out of it for right now. But the point is, when you start getting into this area, the New Age area and the UFO area and whatever, you're dealing in spiritual terms. And this is one place where the roads start to part, because either you have the benefit of a biblical grounding, which we think is very crucial anchor point, or if not, you're very, very vulnerable to substantial deception. You need to recognize the Bible portrays Satan as our adversary, and his primary skill, his primary tool, is deceit, deception, what have you. And so when you're dealing in a spiritual area, you're really dealing in an area that potentially is very, very dangerous. And that's one reason why in our book. We try to, on the one hand, research it well, on the other hand, also highlight some of the anchor points, some of the steps that one should take. And, of course, fundamentally, without getting into all the details, it's one to have a good, solid biblical basis and to really understand who Jesus Christ really was and is and what his real mission is. Because strange as it may sound, the whole UFO area, the whole this whole area, it comes puts you headlong right into the issue of who are we really?
Right.
What is God's plan for us? What is his plan to redeem us from the predicament that we're in? And so that's an exciting study, a fascinating study,
right?
But also one of incredible priority as one tries to step back and assess and amend, if necessary, one's worldview.
Let me ask you this, and this is kind of a recap now of what we've talked about, and a question that is very relevant to the whole issue. There are a lot of authors, and you've mentioned the New Age, and you've mentioned a lot of theories being written about in books and things like that are very popular. But, you know, some people would say, Chuck, your theories hold very close to someone, say, like Zechariah Sitchin, who's written just a whole load of books about ancient beings that are actually our ancestors who bred us for food, for the gods, if you will.
Yeah, you pick an interesting guy. Sitchin's quite a character, and he has quite a lot of scholarship, pursuit of scholarship. He's fun to read. But you need to understand, of course, and of course, before him, there was Emanuel Velikovsky, who really was a very competent scholar.
Right.
And, of course, you had the popularists like Eric Van Doniken, who, of course, got discredited subsequently. But the point is there are writers here, and they're very colorful. But the first problem is how to measure these things, because there's some very colorful writers that sound good.
Exactly. That's what the question is. How do you...
Very easy, and because I have an anchor point. And the anchor point, the yardstick against which I can measure this, is the Bible. And that may sound, that's just another cultural tradition. Not so. One of the great discoveries of our time is that the Bible, which consists of 66 separate books, penned by 40 different guys over thousands of years, is an integrated message. We now discover that the very text itself, every number, every place name, every detail of the Hebrew and the Old Testament, the Greek and the New, is there evidences an integrity of design. It's really a singular message. And furthermore, you can demonstrate that this collective message system has its origin from outside the time domain. Now, what's exciting about that is that's empirically verifiable. And so the reason I ascribe to this collection of 66 books supernatural origin is because it can be demonstrated. And secondly, because of that, it becomes then my hard point, the yardstick by which I measure these other things. Now you say, what do you mean it's outside the time domain? Very simply, you see, we all suffer from this idea that time is linear and absolute, and yet Einstein's theory of relativity has taught us that time is a physical property. Time varies with mass, acceleration, and gravity. And from that we realize that God is not somebody that has lots of time. God is someone who's outside the dimensionality of time altogether.
He's not subject to it at all.
Exactly. And so if God has the technology to create us in the first place, he certainly has the technology to give a message to us. The challenge is, how does he authenticate his message? How does he let us know that the message is really from him and not some kind of contrivance or a fraud? And one way he does that is to write history before it happens. In other words, he alone knows the end from the beginning. Being outside time, those things that are to us a sequence of events, he can see the end from the beginning. And he demonstrates who he is and where he is, so to speak, by writing history in advance. We call that prophecy. And when we discover that the entire history of the nation Israel, its ups, its downs, its dispersal, its regathering, all these things are written down in advance. We can go through, there's over a dozen themes in the scripture that are scenarios, if you will. And what's fascinating is that we now discover that we, right now, are being plunged into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about any other period of time in history, including the time that Jesus walked the shores of Galilee.
You're referring, of course, to the book of Revelation.
Not alone. I'm talking Old Testament, not just New Testament.
Daniel,
Isaiah, even the book of Genesis.
But what you're saying is effectively that the events that we're plunged into at this particular time have been foretold.
Exactly. You're giving me a good excuse to plug a book that'll be out in January.
Okay.
This one I did by myself. It's called Cosmic Codes, Hidden Messages from the Edge of Eternity. And it deals not just with the Bible codes that have been promoted somewhat, but about the DNA and other digital aspects of our universe. But, of course, it's very biblically centered. And it gets into the many different kinds of hidden codes, encryptions, that have been discovered in the biblical text. And the net of all, the final conclusion, is the realization that this book that we happen to have in our laps, called the Bible, is actually an extraterrestrial message which lays out before us our destiny. And it's a very, very exciting study, and it, strange as it may sound, is an echo or a rebound, if you will, from Alien Encounters. And so we've had audio versions of it out for the last couple of months, but the hardback book will be out in January.
Very good. Okay, we're going to take another break. When we come back from that break, what I want to do is I want to translate what we've been talking about into our daily world, all of the New World Order, things like that that may be on the horizon. Okay?
You bet.
All right, Chuck Missler is my guest, co-author of Alien Encounters, and someone who has done a considerable amount of study on this topic and is very knowledgeable. Stay tuned. There's more to come. We'll be right back after this. Again, returning is my guest, Chuck Missler, and we're talking about Alien Encounters. We're talking about the whole paranormal thing, the Nephilim, the Bible, how all this stuff has applicable views to what we see going on in the world today. And Chuck, that's where I want to kind of focus on this segment. What do we see translated in everyday life? What do we see of this activity that has been going on?
You mean what, of the UFO stuff?
Yes.
Well, it's interesting. I have not, to be a good, honest, candid answer is over the last 6 to 9 months at least, I haven't seen any really conspicuous issues per se. There was a recent conference, I think it was in August of this year, where a panel of 50 scientists met and concluded that the UFO area is legitimate and warrants further investigation.
Right.
Kind of interesting. There have been that kind of thing. I'm not aware, since the book has come out, I have encountered some interesting case studies of apparent abductions that even have lesions. In fact, the two bone biopsies in the hip of a gal.
Is that Dr. Lear's work?
No, this is non-published because I've recommended to the couple involved, although it's well documented, to keep it so it doesn't destroy their life.
Right.
Journalists get hold of this that, you know, ruins their lives. But the point is, I have encountered, if you will, apparent abductees that have lesions. So that's been interesting, but not published because, frankly, in the case I personally had experience with, I encouraged them. They were with their pastor. And the issues were dealt with, I think, quite competently by the very outstanding pastor. But the point is that there's a reality here that's been confirmed to me. But as far as major sightings or other kinds of things, strangely, it's been kind of quiet. I am expectant, but it's a test in my mind, sort of a litmus test, that over the next year or two, whatever, we'll start to see these things tend to come in bunches and clusters.
Mm-hmm.
There was this strange sighting in Phoenix, this giant V-shaped thing that went over Phoenix. I hold the view that that was a military test of some projection holography. There was a non-lethal weapon program, the DOD, that went black in 1994, and among the techniques was projection holography. The thing that happened in Phoenix some time ago, giant thing that went over Phoenix, I think was, frankly, the military trying this on to see if it would work. And I have some reasons why I hold that, why that is my conjecture. But in terms of real, valid, bona fide UFO activity in the last 6 to 12 months, nothing comes to mind, frankly.
Let me ask you this, and this kind of is a good segue to this, because you just mentioned something that agree with you on, too, is the fact that this March 97 Phoenix Lights scenario was most likely probably some advanced project that the government was doing. I agree with that.
That reveals something, though, because it happened in March.
Yeah, it does.
it was not on any national media. It was only in the Arizona media.
Right.
Then 3 months later,
it was picked up.
Suddenly, it's on the front page of USA Today. It's on every major news network. And there was no reason for it to become newsworthy in June, 3 months later.
What do you think it was?
Well, I still hold the view as to what had actually happened. What fascinates me was the demonstration how managed our news is. In other words, the event when it occurred was blacked out from the national media.
Right.
It only occurred in the local media in Arizona, and I have copies of all of that. But then for 3 months, it's a non-issue. And then suddenly, it becomes a national news item instantaneously.
Mm-hmm.
It shows up on USA Today that morning, and that night it's on every major news network. Just a little snippet, just an announcement of what happened, and on to the next point. And what startled me, it wouldn't have any meaning to anyone unless they were watching this kind of thing. But what it demonstrated to me rather dramatically is how managed news is in this area. And one of the things that it makes research in the UFO area so difficult is the prevalence of disinformation, as not only are a lot of the key stories spiked or withheld, but on top of that, there's all kinds of disinformation promoted, and some of it involves fairly substantial budgets. The alien autopsy video that floated around for a while, pretty provably a hoax on the one hand, and yet not the kind of thing that a group of pranksters could pull off on the weekend. That had a real budget.
Sure.
And I was inquiring about this through some of my classified friends, and they pointed out to me, Chuck, there's no shortage of funds in the black community. What they mean by black, of course, isn't racist. They're talking about the highly classified, compartmented programs. For some reason, there's more than one group. There are several groups in the deeply classified community that, for whatever reason, busy themselves at promoting disinformation in this area. And the number of us who've been following this are at a total loss to even conjecture as to what the agenda might be.
Well, let me ask you this. In your book, you have a quote by Dr. Henry Kissinger.
Uh-huh.
And could you recall that quote?
No, I don't know.
Okay, it's the one where he talks about the people would gladly give up their individual rights to an alien threat, real or promulgated.
Yes, there's a number of those quotes, fortunately, we have a good index, so I can probably find it here pretty quickly. But the point is, are people. MacArthur made his famous speech at West Point. Reagan referred to it three times, and the Kissinger quotes another one, which implies that one of the pressures for global government is the possibility of a cosmic threat of some kind, and how people would be glad to give up their freedoms if confronted with that kind of a threat.
Right. How could, and let me ask you this, do you feel, and of course this is speculation, theory or whatever, do you feel that there is some interface between maybe a cabal or a group of people? Do you think there's an interface between this and the UFO thing or what's behind that curtain?
Well, let's back up. Let's make sure. I don't happen to hold to the usual, the conspiracy theory kind of thing where a group of nine men are ruling the world kind of nonsense.
Okay.
I think I'm sophisticated enough to see through that one.
Okay.
But there is another issue. We have reason to believe that the UFO area enjoys a level of classification that is even deeper than our thermonuclear warheads. The Canadians made an inquiry through their embassy to our embassy, and I won't go through the whole scenario, but the net of it was the response they got back turned out actually, in effect, to be a security leak, because the response came back for what they were asking for, which was a UFO-oriented question, enjoyed a higher level of classification than even our thermonuclear warheads. Well, the very disclosure that there is a level of classification like that that exists is in itself a breach of security. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
And so, for some reason, there is a level of security that is deeper than ever. Now, many people who have chased this, have run into what we call Majestic 12 or MJ-12.
Right.
The idea that Truman impaneled 12 prominent Americans into a special commission to deal with UFOs, whatever, back in 47, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
about 20 years ago, a number of documents surfaced that purported to be from MJ-12, training manuals and some correspondence, and those were substantially debunked back about 20 years ago. So most people who follow the UFO area realize that the MJ-12 business was just a hoax of some kind.
Right.
There are those that I respect very, very highly, but I'll leave nameless, that point out that that was probably disinformation to hide MJ-12. In other words, the best way to hide MJ-12 was to have documents surface that are later debunked. You follow me?
Right.
Most people who traffic in this area either think you never heard of MJ-12, or if they have heard about it, believe it's just one of these hoaxes.
The same thing could apply to the Roswell deal.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly what I'm leading up to. All we really know about Roswell is there was a giant cover-up. What really happened, everybody has their weird stories, and our book goes into all that, but the point is, the truth of the matter is, we don't know. What we do know, rather reliably, is that it was a major cover-up, enjoyed very deep classification, that has survived even to this day, more than 50 years after the fact. It still enjoys a form of security that has defied, what, two presidents and three congressmen?
Yes.
To try to crack. So the point is, there is an aspect of the UFO world that is hidden under the mask of deep, deep classification and security.
Could this be used as a springboard to bring about some kind of global domination thing?
There are all kinds of conjectures. Obviously, the conspiracy theorists have a field day with this. There's a whole body of folklore that led to the movie Men in Black and all that stuff, which, of course, was just a spoof. But it builds, of course, on some of the folklore that has to do with, Area 51 and all that stuff.
Right.
Setting all that aside as folklore, I do harbor the strong suspicion that there is, in fact, a covert, highly organized, resourced group that has some agenda in the background. But I won't go beyond that because what frankly I think I know, I don't really know. I mean, it's still, we're in the area of fringe conjecture. In fact, that's something we do not deal with in the book simply because it's too hard to get anything reliable.
Well, the information you've got in this book is excellent, and I highly recommend it to anybody who wants to look at another angle on this whole thing. Chuck, we've got to take a break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up, get some closing comments from you, web addresses and ways that people can get a hold of you or your newsletter.
I'll give them an offer they can't refuse.
Okay, stand by for that, and Chuck Missler is my guest again. We'll be right back after this. I'm Michael Corbin. You're listening to the Paranet Continuum. Returning is my guest, Chuck Missler, and we're about out of time, Chuck. Let's wrap up by you giving your offer. You've got an offer for people.
Yeah, I bet you. Our organization publishes a 48-page monthly news journal. It's normally $20 a year, but we will give any of your listeners a year's subscription without charge. That's just our way of getting acquainted. We attempt to monitor current events, the Middle East, weapons technologies, what have you, and we have we take advantage of a very extensive intelligence network around the world from my old days, and we publish this. We have 100,000 subscribers throughout the world, editions for Europe and Australia and what have you. The point is, if you'll call our office, I'll even pay for the phone call, 1-800-K-HOUSE-1. Koinonia House is the entity, or everybody calls is K-House. 1-800-KHOUSE in the numeral 1. Tell them you are listening to Mike Corman, and they'll get your name and address and give you a year's subscription to our news journal. If you're on the internet, we have all this stuff and a lot of other stuff on our webpage. We get about 3 million visitors a month. It's khouse.org on the World Wide Web, khouse.org. And you're in for a pleasant surprise if you haven't discovered our webpage, and it'll lead you to all kinds of other resources, and we hope you find it provocative.
Chuck, thank you very much for being on the program with us, and as you mentioned, you've got another book coming out in January, did you say?
It should be out in January. It's called, in hardback, Cosmic Codes, Hidden Messages from the Edge of Eternity.
Okay, and people will also, if they visit your website or take your newsletter, will be able to stay abreast of other developments and other publications.
You betcha, absolutely.
Okay. Chuck, thank you very much. I really appreciate the time, and we'll have you back again soon.
I appreciate your hospitality. I'd be glad to be with you anytime, my friend.
Okay, thanks, Chuck.
God bless.